Arthur said, pulling Sophie forward and calling back to the witches. We'll take the east lanes. You girls take the west. The three witches sprinted away from them into the next row of cottages. Annadel tore up a rosebed. Hester kicked aside a bicycle. Dot peeked inside mailboxes. Hester snarled, Dot, you spitwad. It's not going to be in a mailbox. The skim flew out of the box right into Dot's mouth, then shot back out, rocketing past the witches down the street and under the door of a big grey cottage at the end.
I take that back, said Hester,
hurtling towards the cottage as Annadil raced after her, the two witches shooting their glow into the sky to signal the others. Sophie and Agatha's glow flared from the next street, acknowledging the witches. But Dot still hadn't budged. Rooted by the mailbox, her eyes on the house where the skim had gone.
Daddy?
She gasped. Dot burst into the house.
Daddy, where are you?
A meaty arm slung Dot against the wall.
Don't move,
a deep voice said. Dot lifted her eyes to see her father holding her back with his big, hairy hand. The sheriff was tall, with a bushy black beard, a greasy mane of hair, and a bloated belly that hung over his belt, jangling with his jail keys. But his dark, stony eyes weren't on his daughter. They were on the skim, floating in the foyer of the dimly lit house. The skim was lethally sharp at both ends, one end pointing at Dot and the sheriff, the other at Annadil and Hester, who were plastered against another wall.
Tell us how to kill it, Dot,
the sheriff demanded quietly.
Tell us what you did before.
Dot swallowed, feeling Hester and Annadil staring at her. Her friends cornered beneath the sheriff's famous grey sack, hooked on a wall. Annadil's red eyes flicked back to the skim.
Use your demon,
she whispered to her friend.
Not unless I have to,
Hester whispered back.
If my demon dies, I die.
The sheriff squeezed his daughter harder.
Dot, hurry.
The front door flung open. Sophie and Agatha busted in, fingertips lit, only to see the skim pivot in their direction, deadly tip glowing. The girls stumbled back to a wall, tripping over shoes, old newspapers, balled-up underpants, and dirty dishes.
What do we do?
Sophie breathed. Nothing stupid, said Agatha, shielding her. The skim spun between the pair of captives, like the arrow on a game wheel, as if deciding who to kill first. Dot and her father, Sophie and Agatha, Hester and Annadil. All of them looked at each other, thinking the same thing. There were six of them and one skim. If they worked together, surely they could take it down. But perhaps the skim sensed these thoughts, for suddenly, through the open window, more skims silently floated into the room, joining the first. Two, then four, then six. Each one turned razor sharp and pointed at a prisoner's heart.
Dot, what are you waiting for? What did you do at the Four Point?
The sheriff hissed, fingers digging into her. Dot winced under her father's grip.
What is he talking about?
Sophie blurted.
She saved all of you there.
The sheriff shot back.
She beat the snake single-handedly. Why isn't she doing it now?
Dot's face was blotchy, her eyes ignoring her father and fixed on the skim pointing at her. "We need to send a signal to the rest of the crew," she said shakily. "We need to tell them not to come here." On cue, Anadil's rats skittered out of her pocket, crawling down their master's leg and shuttling for the door. The door crashed open, sending the rats flying as Beatrix, Rena, Ruven, Nicola and Hort barreled in together. They saw the skims and scattered with shrieks and shouts to the walls. Five more skims breezed through the window, each turning knife sharp and taking its place in front of a student. Three smaller skims coasted in and set aim at Anadil's rats. But still, none of the eels attacked. "What are they waiting for?" Sophie said, watching the scaly ribbons hover patiently in front of their victims. The sheriff's eyes were widening, his hand slowly loosening on his daughter.
"It's not true, is it? You didn't save anyone at the Four Point. You made it all up."
Dot's nose started running. I just wanted you to like me again. I wrote you letters from school asking you to forgive me. I missed you so much, but you wouldn't even answer them."
"Because you're a curse," her father snarled. "You helped Robin Hood escape. You sided with my nemesis over your own family. And now, when I finally think you've redeemed yourself, when I can look the people in the eye and tell them you've made something of your life, you humiliate me again?"
The sheriff burned red, nostrils flaring.
"I thought at that school they'd teach you some sense, but instead it's made you more stupid and delusional than you already were. The only reason you got into that school in the first place was because I did a favor for the schoolmaster. Yeah, you didn't know that, did you? Came to me with something he needed, and in return, he took you off my hands. Plus, he enchanted my catching sack so that if I ever catch Robin again with it, this time, there's nothing you can do to foul it up. Robin would still be in jail if it weren't for you. I'd be a legend in the woods. But then you stole my keys and snuck them to him, all because you wanted to be his friend. As if anyone could ever be your friend. Should have known your letter was all lies. Was there anything true in there about you beating the snake? About you being the real lion? Even one word?"
Dot didn't answer. The sheriff bared his teeth at her.
"You ugly, disgusting pig."
He raised his hand to strike her. Hester's demon slammed into him, bashing the sheriff in the groin with its horns. Before it could gore him again, a skim ripped through the demon's claw, pinning the demon to the ceiling. The sheriff crumpled to the floor, wailing high-pitched noises. Hester gasped, buckling against the wall as if the wind had been crushed out of her, her skin turning white. Overhead, her red-skinned demon bleated in pain.
"Hester? You okay?"
Agatha sputtered. But Hester wasn't listening, her eyes bloodshot and still fixed on the sheriff.
"Too bad for you. Your daughter has friends," she said. "Lots of friends," Anadil seethed. "And if you ever touch Dot, you ever speak to her like that again, those friends will tear out your throat," said Hester. "We will kill her own father to protect her, and we won't feel an ounce of guilt. You don't know us.
You don't know what we're capable of. And you don't know the truth about your daughter either, said Anadil, red glare slashing through the sheriff. She isn't an embarrassment, or ugly, or any of the other lies you dump on her. She's a miracle. You know why? Because she came from stock like you, and is still the best friend anyone could ask for.
Dot's face flooded with tears, her whole body quivering. The sheriff sobbed in pain behind the couch. Dot shook her head, panicking. You shouldn't have hurt Daddy. It was my fault. I shouldn't have lied. Agatha moved to comfort her, but the skim aimed at Agatha jerked as if to strike, and Sophie snagged her back. Nothing stupid, remember? Sophie said.
We can't wait here like sitting ducks, said Hort, shirking from his skim. We have to do something.
Our finger glows don't work against skims. We have no weapons, said Beatrix.
The crew looked at Nicola for ideas, but she seemed to be in a trance, her narrowed eyes roaming the scene. What is it, Nick? Said Agatha.
The skims were looking for someone, said the first year, and now they've lured us here. They lured all of us here.
But if they're looking for one of us, why haven't they attacked? They're using us as bait to find who they're really looking for. This whole thing is another one of the snake's traps.
The door smashed open, this time ripping off its hinges. Tedros stood in the threshold, his black hooded coat silhouetted in evening light. His eyes were watery and red, his face flushed. He spotted Anadil and Hester first.
Agatha's glow. I saw it. Where is she?
But now he glimpsed the Sheriff of Nottingham crumpled on the floor, the demon impaled on the ceiling, his classmates fixed to the walls, the skims aimed at their hearts. Then Sophie. Then Agatha. But before he could move towards his princess, the nearly 20 skims moved first, turning swiftly from their chosen targets and all pointing in Tedros's direction.
No,
he breathed. With a deafening scream, the skims flew for his head. Tedros dove as the skims ripped past him, tearing open a wall. A split second later, they ripped back out, aiming at the king once more. But Tedros was as strong as he was nimble, ducking under furniture and hurling chairs and lamps and kitchen pots at the skims, which obliterated everything he threw in their direction.
Get out of the house, he commanded his classmates. Now!
Ruvan, Hort, Beatrix, Rena, and Nicola fled through the open door. Agatha instinctively surged towards Tedros, but Sophie blocked her.
I have to help him, Agatha cried. By getting cut up into 1,000 pieces, you don't have anything to fight with, Sophie blistered.
But now the skims had the upper hand on Tedros, spreading out and coming at him from different angles, forcing him against the windowsill.
He doesn't even have Excalibur. He can't fight them with his bare hands, Agatha panicked, struggling in Sophie's grip. Where's Lancelot? Lance was supposed to be here helping him.
There's only one way to help now, said Hester, grabbing Sophie. The lion. We have to find him.
Agatha spun to Sophie. Use your map. Suddenly alert, Sophie emptied the vial on her neck, unfurling the quest map. The skims had Tedros checkmated, trapped against the windowsill with no other move to make. They glittered brighter, each aiming at a different part of his body.
There he is, Sophie said, tracking Rian's name. He's close to us, getting closer and closer even. Wait a second. The skims launched for Tedros. A flash of gold blasted through the window, crossing in front of Tedros's body. Skims slammed into the solid gold of a lion's mask as its wearer swung two torches like swords, lighting eels on fire. The boy landed on his feet, pulling off his lion mask.
Here, Your Highness,
Rian said, tossing Tedros a torch. Tedros caught it. He stared open-mouthed at the boy who'd just saved his life. Tan and copper-haired, his lean, muscular frame clad in a blue and gold suit. Then the skims came stabbing at them again.
At my wing,
Tedros ordered Rian, launching at the eels with his torch. Rian obeyed straight away, flanking the king as the two boys swept their torches in perfect sync, burning through skims which fell to the ground shrieking. Agatha broke from Sophie, sprinting to help them.
Stay back,
Tedros and Rian yelled at once. Agatha stalled mid-run. She, Sophie, and the three witches watched wide-eyed as Tedros and his new knight teamed effortlessly, twin swordsmen calling out moves to each other as they dispatched the scaly ribbons.
Feint left, Tedros shouted. Parry right,
Rian called back. Hester could see the awe on Agatha's face, watching Tedros join forces with someone his equal. At school, Chadwick had always been Tedros's sidekick, but he could never truly keep up with the prince. Now, Agatha was seeing what it was like for Tedros to finally have a teammate to rely on. This whole time, Agatha had thought she was that teammate. But now she realized that as much as he loved her, Tedros needed someone else. Someone who wasn't his girlfriend. Just like Agatha needed Sophie, even when she had Tedros. Just like Hester needed Anadil and Dot. Because there were all kinds of needs that one person couldn't possibly provide. It's why the bond between two boys was as distinct and mysterious as the bond between two girls. And it's why Agatha had misread Tedros so fundamentally these past 6 months, when she'd felt so alone and unneeded. Because it had nothing to do with Tedros needing his princess, and everything to do with him needing a knight. Meanwhile, the skims didn't leave a scratch on either boy, the two of them so melded and ruthless in destroying them that they began wordlessly anticipating each other's moves like silent dancers. And it was only when the last skim fell that Tedros and Rian finally bent over with relief and turned to their audience.
Hi,
Tedros said to Agatha.
Hi,
Agatha said. Breathless. Sophie and Rian exchanged grins. But then more skims came, hundreds of them, swarming through the window, glittering green instead of black. They funneled like a tornado and spewed a gust of wind that snuffed out the boys' torches and knocked the king and his knight into a corner. Before they could recover, the skims cycloned faster, building into a black, scaly suit, then a shimmering green mask, reforming the snake himself. His suit had several holes in it, where scales had been ripped away, revealing milk-white flesh, gashed and bloodied, as if the killed skims from his recent defeats had left both his armor and body vulnerable. The snake's cold gaze settled on the boys trapped in the corner. All the remaining skims on his body turned instantly to spikes, their tips
shining fatally. The snake's emerald eyes darkened with purpose. Then he charged. Rian and Tedros both yelled. A bag swallowed the snake's head, yanking him backwards before engulfing the rest of his body. Stunned, the snake slashed and kicked from inside it, but he couldn't get out. Nor could any sound he was making be heard through the sack's grey fabric, as if he were a dove trapped in a magician's hat. Tedros and Rian lifted their heads to see Dot pull the sack tight, sealing the snake inside.
"Daddy said the schoolmaster enchanted it," she shrugged. "Figured it was worth a shot."
Curled up on the floor, the sheriff gaped in disbelief. So did Sophie, Agatha, Anadil, and Hester, against the wall.
"Guess his fake pen didn't see that coming," Sophie said, watching the snake thrash inside the bag.
"Don't think anyone did," said Anadil, as her three rats sniffed around it, giving Dot flabbergasted looks.
"I thought spells don't work on the snake." "Rafal's spells weren't ordinary spells, apparently," said Hester, prowling towards the sheriff.
"No, please, don't kill me," he choked.
Hester snapped the jail keys off his belt before holding them out to his daughter.
"Help Robin escape all you want, but this one can't escape," said Hester. "Deal?"
Dot smiled, her hand clasping Hester's tight for a moment before she took the key.
"Deal."
"Then let's get this snake to jail," said Hester, as Dot and Anadil dragged the sack towards the door.
"Guess the Skims were looking for Tedros after all," Hester heard Dot say.
"But it still doesn't make any sense,"
Anadil insisted. "I told you in the square. They had to be looking for someone else last night."
Hester moved to help them, but she stopped at the door, watching Tedros approach his new copper-haired friend, the boy's stubble sparkling with sweat.
"Thank you," said Tedros. "Don't think I need this any more, Your Highness," said his knight, handing Tedros his lion mask. He bowed to his king. "My name is Rian."
"You mean Sir Rian," said Tedros.
His knight's steely gaze softened, a blush rising on his amber cheeks. But now his king had seen his princess out of the corner of his eye. Without a word, he swept towards her, lifted her off the ground, and kissed her like it was the very first time. Agatha kissed him back harder, until they both ran out of breath. "No more going at things alone," she said. "No more spending time apart."
"That goes both ways," said Tedros.
He kissed his princess again. Meanwhile, Sophie had cozied up to Rian, who still looked dazed from his exchange with Tedros.
"So, now the lion has a name," she cooed, holding out a kerchief from inside her dress.
He took it and wiped his forehead, his blue-green eyes gazing fervently at her.
"And a lady-in-waiting, I hope."
Sophie touched his chest. "A lady who is waiting for you to ask her on a real date." But Rian wasn't listening. He was looking past her at Tedros. The king's expression had slowly changed, as if the triumph of the moment had worn off,
giving way to cold reality.
Teddy? What is it? Agatha asked.
The king was breathing shallowly now, unable to get words out.
Your Highness, are you okay?
Rian said, rushing to his side, almost pushing Agatha out of the way. He seemed to smell something on Tedros, because he put his nose to the king's neck, and then quickly pulled off Tedros's jacket. Tedros was drenched in blood.
"You're hurt!" Agatha cried.
"No."
Rian put his hands on Tedros's shirt, feeling beneath it.
"There's no wound. It's not his blood."
Agatha and Sophie stared at him.
"Whose blood is it?"
said Agatha. Her prince didn't look at her. Agatha's face changed.
"Tedros?"
she rasped.
"Where's Lancelot?"
Slowly, Tedros lifted his eyes. That's when he started to cry. Chapter 24 Tedros Sides of a Story. A few hours earlier, Tedros had been riding with his father's knight across sun-drenched hills. The two had made good time through the night, moving east from Camelot through the outskirts of Pifflepuff Hills before curving north towards Nottingham. They'd travelled in silence, each in a long black coat with hoods shadowing their faces so that even the few riders they encountered hurried past, avoiding eye contact, no doubt thinking they were minions of the snake. At night, the endless woods usually left Tedros tense and on edge, especially with wanted posters of Lance's and his mother's faces coming in and out of the dark at him, tacked to trees as he passed. But the young king was distracted by the sheer freedom of being on open land. It was the first time in 6 months that he'd left the castle. He hadn't realized how claustrophobic he'd been, sealed inside that crumbling compound, no matter how vast it was. Nor had he realized how relieved he would feel to be away from Excalibur, taunting him at all hours of the day, despite having to replace his hallowed sword with a middling blade he'd scrounged from the armory. And though he could sense the tension inside him building, as if a storm was coming, he felt unshackled out here, more capable and kingly than he ever did in that castle. Even when he and Lance galloped through Camelot's slum cities, spattered with graffiti and effigies denigrating his reign. Even when they skirted the shells of towns ravaged by the snake's attacks. Even when his conversation with his mother kept pulsing in his head.
"She grew too close to your father, Tedros. Always insinuating herself between your father and I. There was something about that room I never liked."
All through the ride, Lancelot's black horse stayed neck and neck with Tedros's blue-grey one, though the king rode at a reckless pace, not stopping once to eat or sleep. Tedros kept glancing over at his knight, but Lance was always there, right beside him, his face as placid as Tedros's was clenched. And indeed, as they reached the outskirts of Nottingham, it was Tedros who finally halted first, his back hurting, stomach aching, and bladder bursting. He almost fell out of the saddle, darting behind a shrubby tree, while Lancelot opened a bag and laid out a late breakfast of smoked salmon, toasted bread, and fresh pears.
"How much longer to Nottingham?"
Tedros asked impatiently when he sat, lumping salmon between pieces of bread and scarfing it down.
You're not due in Sherwood Forest until 6,
said Lancelot, watching Tedros stuff more food in his mouth.
No need to give yourself indigestion. I have business in Nottingham first, said Tedros.
The knight snorted.
No one has business in Nottingham.
I need to see Lady Gremlane.
Thought we were rid of that woman.
I have questions to ask her.
About what?
Tedros glared at the knight.
Nothing that concerns you.
Lancelot took his time putting salmon on his toast.
You're right. None of my business if you think your steward had a child with your father.
Tedros stopped eating, mouth full.
You don't think I've thought it too? For a half second at least,
said Lancelot.
You not pulling Excalibur? Guinevere hating that woman? The snake saying he's Arthur's son? All the clues are there.
And yet, Tedros said,
they don't add up. You didn't know your father when he was young. When he came to the school for good, he was shy, anxious, and a newly crowned king. No matter how popular he became, or how much muscle he built, or how cocky he might have acted, he was always that same Arthur inside. Asking why he was chosen to pull Excalibur over everyone else in the woods. It was Arthur's greatest strength. He relentlessly questioned himself and wanted the brutal truth. It's why he chose me as a best friend, a greasy, pockmarked lout who would tell him that truth instead of all the refined everboys who'd lie and say whatever he wanted to hear. And it's why he chose Gwen over all the other girls who just wanted him for his crown.
But Mother said Lady Gremlane was in love with him, Tedros argued.
Doesn't matter. Arthur followed his heart.
The knight returned, pawing at his unruly curls.
He was too faithful to the truth to sneak around with this Gremlane creature. Gwen and I were the ones who traded in lies, not Arthur. Whoever this snake is, he's not your father's son.
I want to make sure of it, Tedros pressed. I want to hear it from her mouth. Lancelot put down his food.
Sometimes the last person you should ask for the truth is the one who knows it.
What do you mean?
Just because Lady Gremlane knows the truth doesn't mean she'll tell the truth. Look at your own father. Every girl at school was in love with Arthur, every single one. They all wanted to be his queen, but not Guinevere. That didn't stop him from loving her, of course. Still, he knew she didn't love him, even if she never revealed this truth to him herself. But I did. I told Arthur that Gwen didn't love him because it was obvious to both of us that she was in love with me. Yet no matter how much Arthur valued the truth, in this one case, the truth wasn't good enough for him. He thought Camelot needed Guinevere. He thought having her as queen would make him a better king. It didn't matter that she didn't love him. If he could bend this truth through sheer force of will, it would mean all his doubts about being chosen king were wrong. That he deserved to be good's leader because he knew how to put good first.
The knight gazed squarely at Tedros.
That's how I know for sure
There was nothing between your father and Lady Gremlane. Because King Arthur staked everything on his love for Guinevere. Everything. And it's why he lost everything when she left.
Tedros shook his head, riling up.
But that's your side of the story. It's the side you tell yourself to feel better about taking my mother away from my father. It's the side that makes my father look like the villain. But what if there's another side? What if Arthur knew you and my mother were secretly seeing each other, and so he took revenge with Lady Gremlane? Or what if my father sensed my mother didn't love him and began to fall in love with his steward instead? Or what if my father made one bad decision, had one bad night?
All of these are possible, said the knight. But beware, trying to bend the truth to fit your story, instead of facing it head on. That was your father's mistake, and that's how a snake becomes a lion, and a lion becomes a snake. Because the more you bend the truth to fit a story, the more it turns into lies, without you even realizing it.
Says the one who traded in lies, Tedros replied.
Lancelot went quiet.
After a successful battle or war, it is tradition for a king to exchange gifts with his best knight in front of the kingdom,
he said.
Arthur and I always gave each other the same gifts. I kneeled before Arthur's queen and kissed her hand in tribute. And in return, Arthur offered me anything on earth a king could provide a man.
What did you ask for? Tedros said.
Always the same. Nothing at all,
said Lancelot.
I'd already taken from him everything a man could take. My gift was meant to tell him that.
He looked at Arthur's son.
Is it really a lie, if someone is unwilling to see the truth?
Now it was Tedros who fell silent. Lancelot cleaned up the remains of their food and drank from his water jug.
I spoke to a few of the leaders in the castle as the guards took them to their rooms. They mentioned something about the snake having a powerful suit of armor made out of living eels. Skims, he calls them. They think that there's a connection between these skims and the snake's life force. That there's magic in his blood. But they also say the skims can be killed. Kill enough of them, and you can penetrate the snake's flesh.
So he's just as mortal as you and me, then, said Tedros, looking Lance in the eye.
See, he's someone's son after all. Well, then seeing as this snake and his minions are still on the loose, if anyone asks who you are while we're in Nottingham, you're someone's son too,
said the knight, pulling the young king to his feet.
Whose?
Tedros asked, confused. Lancelot grinned as he walked towards the horses.
Mine.
Soon they reached the entrance point to Nottingham, an imposing, sooty, black brick jail at the top of a hill, and a gleaming bronze statue of the sheriff in front of it.
The land of law and order,
Lancelot muttered, eyeing the welcome sign down the slope with a cartoon of the sheriff chasing Robin Hood.
Any kingdom that promises law and order surely has neither.
From the hill crest, Lancelot could see the lush outskirts of Sherwood Forest a mile north, and steered his horse towards it.
This way,
Tedros corrected, riding his horse away from the forest and towards the center of town.
Don't be a fool. The second we cross into Sherwood Forest, we'll be safe for the night.
Lancelot scolded, nosing his horse next to the king's.
We left Camelot so that you could meet the lion boy. And that's the only reason we left. We still have 2 hours until I have to be at Marion's Arrow. Do you even know where Gremlane lives? I'll ask someone. We haven't seen a soul. I'll figure it out. It's an unnecessary risk, Tedros. It's something I have to do.
Tedros held firm. Lancelot exhaled. It was mid-afternoon in Nottingham, but there wasn't a person to be found in the square, the only sound the out-of-rhythm clop of the two men's horses. Lancelot peered around at the closed shops and empty streets.
No animals, he said. First sign of trouble.
Tedros wasn't listening. He'd spotted something in the window of the sheriff's blotter, a copy of the latest Royal Rot, with a headline about Lady Gremlane above the fold. He couldn't read the full article from outside the window, so he punched in the corner of the glass pane and pulled the paper out.
So much for law and order,
mumbled Lancelot. Tedros scanned the story. Has Lady Gremlane been fired from Camelot for a second time? 15 years ago, King Arthur's once steward was exiled from the castle by Guinevere, rumour has it, for being too chummy with the king, which both Lady Gremlane and Guinevere have vehemently denied. But in an ironic twist, Guinevere's son Tedros, our so-called new king, latched on to Lady Gremlane as his own steward, just like his father once did. However, the last 2 nights, Lady Gremlane has been seen in her hometown of Nottingham by numerous observers. Said Bertie, an attendant at the Nottingham prison, no one's been in the house at 246 Morgores Street for several years now, but neighbours saying that haughty woman's back. We asked Bertie, could she be in Nottingham to visit family?
She ain't got no family here, Bertie replied. What about a vacation? No one vacations in Nottingham except stupid tourists thinking they might see Robin Hood. So, what's Bertie's conclusion? She ran afoul of the king and came back to lick her wounds. Good place to hide your face, Nottingham. No one's gonna find you here except nosy neighbours. And the royal rot, of course. Stay tuned as we pursue an exclusive interview with the king's disgraced steward.
Tedros folded up the newspaper, thrust it back through the window, and used his finger glow to repair the glass.
Come on, he said, hopping onto his horse. We need to find Morgores Street.
A booming crash echoed in the distance. King and knight swiveled to see a plume of smoke and dust rising at the top of the hill near the jail, though they couldn't see what had caused it.
Something's wrong. Let's get to the forest,
Lance urged.
10 minutes. That's all I need. Then you can feast at Marion's Arrow while I meet this lion fellow and tell him in no uncertain terms that I already have a knight,
said Tedros, riding towards the cottage lanes.
Happy to let him have the job if he wants it,
Lancelot growled, following him. But Tedros was already amongst the houses, shifting and squinting in his saddle to make out the streets around him. Old Herd Court, Magpie Grove, Marion Mews. He could see people peeping through curtains from inside their cottages. They all had the same spooked expressions, their eyes tracking him. He pulled his hood farther over his head.
"They think we're the snake's men," said Tedros. "They're waiting for us to attack them."
"Or waiting for something to attack us," said his knight. "Something they know is out here that we don't."
Tedros met his eyes, a flicker of doubt passing over the king's face.
"Look, there it is,"
he exclaimed suddenly, spying the sign for Morgor's Street over Lance's shoulder.
"Gremlin's house is that where—"
A gleaming black blur flew under Lance's horse, and the animal bucked in surprise, neighing wildly, almost throwing the knight off. Tedros whirled around, following the gleam, but it was gone.
"What was that?"
Lance panted, trying to soothe his horse. Tedros scanned the clear crossroads.
"Must have been a bat or a crow. Come on,"
he said, pulling his horse towards the lane ahead. But his horse wouldn't move. Tugging his head in the other direction, Lancelot's horse oriented the same way.
"They want us to get to the forest," the knight said.
Tedros dismounted and jogged towards Morgor's Street, leaving Lancelot and the horses behind. Rounding the corner, he tracked the street numbers. 232, 240, 244, until he found a two-floor white cottage with 246 above the door in peeling red paint.
"This is Gremlane's?"
The front garden was dead and overgrown with bristly weeds. The cottage's white panels were spotted with mildew and bird droppings. Both windows were cracked, with tiny holes in them as if they'd been shot through with marbles. In leaving Camelot, Lady Gremlane had traded a ramshackle castle for an even more run-down house. As Tedros approached the front door, he noticed the welcome mat. An embroidered needlepoint of young King Arthur with a halo over his head and the words stitched beneath him in golden thread, "The once and future king." He'd seen these before, sold cheaply in Camelot street markets. They were popular with the poorest citizens of the kingdom who'd lionized the lofty king, and with zealots who saw Tedros's father not as a man, but as an immortal saint who would one day return from death to reclaim his kingdom. But Lady Gremlane? She didn't fit into either category. She worked for his father. She was Arthur's friend. Even if she did secretly love him, having this in front of her house felt like something other than love. Something creepier. It made Tedros's stomach lurch. He caught a whiff of powdered rose at the door. Quickly he put his hand on the knocker, but then he smelled the rosy scent, overtaken by a hot, sweaty musk. Tedros turned, frowning.
"Where you go, I go," groused Lancelot, sword gleaming on his belt.
Tedros turned back and knocked hard on the door. No one answered.
"Glad that's settled,"
said the knight, starting to drag him away. Tedros unsheathed his sword, aimed the hilt against the door lock, and smashed it.
"Few months as king and you've gone vigilante," Lancelot marveled.
Tedros shoved the door open and went inside the house, Lancelot hewing close to him.
"Did you stalk my father like this too?"
Tedros sniped.
Didn't smell as nice as you, though. You know, with the number of baths you take, it's a wonder you get any work as king done at all."
Tedros stopped in front of him.
"Lance."
The knight looked up and stiffened. Lady Gremlane's house had been ravaged. The furniture upended and slashed open, closet doors splintered and rugs frayed. Lampshades ripped apart, their glass bases shattered, books shredded, pages showered around like confetti.
"Who would do this?" Tedros asked, stupefied. "It's like an army shot the place through with arrows."
Lancelot studied a pillow speared with holes, the stuffing spilling out, then squinted around the room.
"Only there aren't any arrows here."
Glancing inside a closet, Tedros found a safe box broken open and dumped on the floor. He sifted through the wreckage. First, some old clippings from the Camelot Courier, the top one, announcing his father's coronation, with a portrait of Arthur accepting the crown and a young Lady Gremlane smiling to the side of the stage, while another clipping featured a picture of young Arthur and young Gremlane sitting together, with the caption, "King and his steward hard at work in the early days of his reign." There was also a copy of The Royal Rot, with the headline, "Guinevere Who? How Lady Gremlane is the Real Secret to King Arthur's Success." Tedros flung it aside, noticing a ledger beneath it with a handwritten label. "Camelot Beautiful." Tedros opened the ledger, only to see all its pages blank, except for a business card clipped to the last one. "Albemarle, Licensed Manager, Bank of Putsey." But there was something stuck to the back of the ledger, Tedros realized. A stack of letters, banded together, addressed to Lady Gremlane. He peeled them off the ledger and flipped through the stack, his eyes widening. All of the letters were in his father's handwriting.
"Tedros, look at this,"
Lancelot's voice said. Tedros shoved the letters in his coat, along with the business card, and moved out of the closet to find his knight inspecting the wall. Black marks streaked across it with a strange wet sheen. Tedros scraped his hand across the marks, then peered closely at his fingertips. Shiny black debris like sequins had embedded in his skin.
"Snake scales,"
said Lancelot ominously. Tedros thought of that black blur he saw in the street. Something rustled upstairs. The two men stared at each other.
"Lady Gremlane?"
Tedros called out. No answer. Warily, Tedros ascended the staircase, Lancelot behind him. On the second floor, they found more of the scaly black marks on the hallway walls and on a square hatch built into the ceiling, presumably a portal to the attic. More rustling came from the room at the end of the hall.
"Lady Gremlane, are you here?"
Tedros called again, inching forward. Lancelot drew his sword behind him. Together, they turned the corner into a bedchamber that had been pulverized as ruthlessly as the downstairs rooms. The mattress had been flung off its frame, the white sheets sliced to ribbons, the pillows gutted of feathers. A blue-green butterfly rustled feverishly against the window, trying to find a way out. Tedros's shoulders relaxed. He looked at Lancelot, hunching over the bed.
"What is it?"
Tedros asked. His knight held up a torn strip of white sheet. A big splotch of blood had soaked it through. Fresh blood.
"Lady Gremlane?"
Tedros hollered. Lancelot checked closets. Tedros searched under the bed and behind furniture. But there were no other bloodstains or signs that his steward was in this house. Tedros's boot caught on something sticky. He looked down at a glob of black goo beaten to a pulp. A shadow came over him, and he swiveled to see Lance looming over his shoulder.
"It's one of those skims, isn't it? The things the snake is made of," Tedros asked. "It's why all the villagers must be hiding. The snake was here."
"And from the looks of it, Lady Gremlane had her way with the skim he sent for her,"
said Lancelot, before glancing back at the bed.
"Though judging from that blood, it may have had its way with her first."
"But her body isn't here. That means she's still alive, wherever she is."
"Or lying in a ditch with her throat cut,"
said Lancelot. He nudged at the dead skim with his boot.
"Doubt this thing came alone. If the snake wants to kill Lady Gremlane, he'll find her."
"But it doesn't make any sense,"
Tedros said, shaking his head.
"If Lady Gremlane is the snake's mother, why would he want to kill her?"
A sharp squeal came from the first floor, like a tea kettle at full steam. Lancelot pulled his sword, eyeing Tedros.
"Stay here."
The knight crept back down the stairs. Blade at the ready, Tedros waited at the top of the twisting steps. He couldn't see where the knight had gone.
"Lance?"
he said. No answer. Tedros had a bad feeling in his gut, a feeling that told him to follow Lancelot. Gripping his sword harder, he started to descend. Something wet dripped on his face. Tedros smeared it off and looked at his hand. Blood. He craned up and saw more droplets of blood leaking from the edges of the hatch built into the ceiling.
"Lance!"
he bellowed down the stairs. Still nothing. Tedros dragged the frayed mattress out of the bedroom and shoved it into the hall. Standing on its edge, he sheathed his sword and reached up for the hatch's handle, but his fingers couldn't catch it. He jumped a few times, but he still fell short. Finally, he took a running start, rebounded off the mattress, and grabbed hold of the hatch with both hands, yanking it open. He hung from the handle, kicking his legs mid-air as he muscled his hands onto the sides of the floor above him, pulling himself through. A heavy weight slammed him in the head. Before he could scream, it slammed him again. Gasping in shock, he felt cold hands seize him by the neck and drag the last of his body into the attic. Tedros wished he'd blacked out, so he didn't have to feel this kind of pain. As if his head had been cracked open like an egg and the yolk set on fire. Curled up on the floor, he ran his hand down the back of his hair, expecting a mass of blood or brains, but instead found a swollen lump at the ridge of his skull. He pried open his eyes to watery slits and saw a blurred version of Lady Gremlane standing in an attic, her turban gone, her dark brown hair long and wild, her makeup spattered, and the shoulder of her lavender robes drenched in blood. There was terror in her eyes. Something else, too.
Madness, Tedros thought.
His gaze moved to her hand. She was holding a hammer. The flat side was coated with black, scaly goo.
"The voices. I heard voices," she stammered. "I didn't know it was you." You can't be here. He'll find you.
Who will?
Tedros said, struggling.